He is a host of Nothing Personal with David Sampson, the podcast on CBS Sports HQ. And I'm gonna bring David Sampson. You've also got another thing, though. You got a sit down type of thing happening, don't you, Sampson? And I think Dan Lebatard is your first guest, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, so I just started. So Nothing Personal is 45 minutes of me just talking about sports and business and entertainment and politics. But I said, you know, I'm going to start a Sampson sit-down, you know, not every day, but every couple weeks maybe, where I choose someone who I've known through my career, through my life, and just have a 45-minute interesting conversation. I did it with Lebatard to start as the first episode, and we had a funny 45-minute conversation just because there's so many stories and so many things that go on over the course of a career or a life that most people just don't talk about. And you know me, Jeff, I'm willing to tell any story.
Well, that is, I still think the podcast should be called Unfiltered, but I mean, I'm sure that's already taken. And quite frankly, it's why we love you. I got to ask you about the Oakland A's and the Oakland Coliseum and the failure on the part of the A's to pay, I think it was $1.2 million rent on, I believe it was Tuesday. Now look, I think that someplace between the stand of the Players Association and someplace between the stand of Major League owners, there's an area there where there's a lot of accuracy about the financial impact of COVID on sports. Dave, I am a little skeptical, and maybe I shouldn't be. Maybe you can talk me out of this. Should I be skeptical about the A's at this time not making their rent payment? Because that does seem to play into the hands of everything Rob Manfred is saying, doesn't it?
Well, yes. It just depends what your point of view is. So if you're saying, are you skeptical that John Fisher, the owner of the Oakland A's, the child of the founders of Gap, who yes. purportedly is worth, call it $1 billion, call it $500 million, call it $2 billion. It doesn't matter. Are you skeptical that he doesn't have $1.2 million to pay to the city of Miami? You don't have to be skeptical about that. That's 100% true. He does have that money. However, this is a straight business proposition where he's got a lease to play baseball in clearly the worst stadium. I think it's worse than the Thunderdome in Tampa. The worst stadium. He's been unable to get public money into a new stadium in Oakland. Wanted to go to San Jose. It didn't work out. There's been, you know, the trials and tribulations there. Mm-hmm. Anytime you have leverage in any negotiation or anytime there's a provision in a contract where you cannot pay money, it doesn't matter if you're a billionaire or a millionaire or a centenaire, you don't pay the money.
Mm-hmm. So he's just,
well, the cynic in me loves that.
Yeah. Yeah. Because there is a provision here where there is a clause in that lease, correct? That he can invoke to justify not paying rent, or at least ask questions about the conditions under which he would pay rent. I think that's right, David, isn't it?
That's exactly what happened. And I would have done the exact same thing. And I understand it's not a popular move, but when you run a team, you're not running for, you know, Miss Congeniality. You're running a business, and the Oakland A's are not a good business. They lose money year after year. They've got issues with revenue sharing. They don't get their full complement of revenue sharing. So it's Suris galore there in Oakland for John Fisher and the gang. But, you know, from a PR standpoint, his PR advisor said to him, I guarantee it, is the juice worth the squeeze here? Are you willing to get ridiculed across the nation and over the border for this $1.2 million? And John Fisher correctly said what I would have said, which is, that's not the point. Of course, I'll take the ridicule. This is a provision in the lease. And believe me, they enforce every provision that gets extra money from us. So we're going to enforce this provision against them.
David, let's return to our what apparently endless conversation about the restart of baseball in the context of the restart of professional sports in the midst of a pandemic. Since we last had you here, I believe as well that we had the medical protocol. MLB gave the players their 67-point medical protocol, exhaustive medical protocol about the return to play. But we've also had the question of the agreement that was struck in March between the players and the owners about prorated salary and whether or not that takes into account that was binding, even if there were no fans in the stands. Scott Boras has argued that. He argued that on this show and corrected me when I suggested that wasn't the case. But then we had the leak of an email exchange, which suggested that in fact there was some wiggle room there, and that the agreement between the players and the owners in March did not encompass empty stadiums, that they would revisit if their stadiums were going to be empty. That's a bit of a sticking point. That's and a potentially a tricky one. For number one, so where do you think we are in that ongoing discussion between the players and or between the owners and the union about a restart, and how significant is that, those different interpretations of the March agreement?
Let's start with the second one and say there really aren't different interpretations of that agreement. The union, we talked about it maybe even on this show, they kicked the can in terms of that discussion point about what to do if, in fact, baseball is played without fans, and it's clear right in the document. Now, I don't know what Scott said on your program, but what I do know is that Scott is obviously totally gauged by his self-interest, and he doesn't speak, and I've spoken to many other agents and many other players about this exact issue. Scott Boras does not speak for the union. He doesn't speak for any amount of players other than the ones who are underneath his wing. So I'm not sure what document he's reading. He claims to be a lawyer. He may be a lawyer. I think he went to law school like I did. So as a lawyer, I don't know how you read it any other way. It's right in the plain text. And the leaked email was a strategic leak by MLB for sure. I don't agree with it. And I love leaking. I love strategic leaks. I think it can work really well. In this case, MLB didn't need it because MLB has all the power. MLB can decide not to start again. MLB can threaten and say, if you want to get paid anything above the $170 million that we've advanced you, which is $260,000 per player at most, then you're going to have to take an initial pay cut because you haven't taken one yet. Agreeing to your prorated salary is not a pay cut. That's just prorated salary. So where we are is dealing with the economic issue. But before that, as you and I have talked about, it's all about the health protocol. And what's interesting is the players who stood up and said how much they care about health and safety, et cetera, they are trying to find a way to ease the protocols because their view is, and I talked about it on Nothing Personal today, if we test every day and we test negative, then we should be in the clubhouse and everything should be fine. Everything's hunky-dory, obviously ignoring the reality of what a false negative could mean. So it'll be interesting to see what issues MLB players are willing to die on the vine for. My experience says a lot of it is about their creature comforts and the way they like to travel.
David, this would exist of you just sort of taking a guess as to what the resolution will be here. But how do you think the finances will ultimately work between Major League Baseball and its right holders? Its rights holder partners on a national level, the ESPNs, the Turners, the Foxes, et cetera. If the season is shortened to something like 82 games, if the playoffs, let's say, and again, it's just sort of a thought exercise, just happens to be less playoff games than in previous years, how do you think the finances of that work out for this year?
Well, it's in the contract what happens. So you talk about the shortened regular season. The national contracts include a guaranteed number of games, and it's a range of games, let's say between 20 and 40, because you don't know if series will go four games or seven games. And if, as long as you're in that bandwidth, there is no make good. There's no sort of refund that gets given to the networks at the end of the contract term at the end of the year. It's different negotiated points in different national contracts. But the shorter regular season is not a big deal because for the networks who have Sunday night games or Thursday night games or game of the week, you're right, there'll be fewer of them. But the real money by the networks, the return on their investment in the leagues comes during playoff time. So the better question is, will they get and do they need permission from their national broadcast partners to move the playoffs out of the October window? And the answer is they likely don't need it under the letter of the contract, but they really are going to get it because one of the things that they'll need from their partners is acquiescence in terms of putting the playoff games on the schedule. Just take Fox. You need them on the schedule in October here in the U.S., and that is a crucial part of the national broadcast revenue.
You know, David, it's fascinating hearing you say that because Richard and I had a back and forth yesterday. We were exchanging texts. One of the things that the Premier League, I don't know if I'd say it's discovered, But one of the sort of wrinkles in the Premier League TV contract in England is that the league pays a fine, what amounts to a fine, for having games, for having the season fail to conclude by June. So in other words, they will, when they start up again, if they will finish the regular season, they will get money from their TV contract. But the number that I looked at, they also have to give back roughly 250 million euros to broadcasters because they aren't finishing their season during the allocated time frame. Is that something that would be that is common to baseball contracts as well? In other words, if my network is showing, I don't know, if my network is showing Marlins games, would I have a clause in the contract that would say, oh, and by the way, if you don't get all your games done by, let's say, the end of October, the middle of November, whatever, you owe me money?
Yeah, it's about windows of availability, and that's what we were just talking about just now.
Right.
That when you do a TV deal, you say we'll make available 145 games between April and the end of September. And then Fox, or whoever your regional partner is, they will have the opportunity to choose games, and you make a schedule that way. I cannot imagine what you're saying is going to happen, where the Premier League is going to actually refund 250 million euros, because you've got to have a negotiation with your TV partners, because that just is not economically feasible. From a local broadcast standpoint, it's a non-starter. If the regional networks in the U.S. come back to the teams and say, if you play 81 games, but you play through October, we're going to pretend that all those October games don't count because you're supposed to end in September, that would be a deal breaker for teams. So I wouldn't expect that provision. Even if it exists, it would there be a side letter, a negotiated resolution to that.
Okay. I also want to move back to another aspect of Richard's question about the economics of this agreement. One of the things you're starting to hear a little bit now, and it's mostly, I admit it, I've heard it mostly from agents, from a couple of agents I sort of keep in contact with, is that one of the reasons we haven't heard Major League Baseball formally propose that 50-50 revenue share is that the end game for Major League Baseball is to actually get players to agree to some sort of deferral, which we've seen in the NHL. I think they've talked about, I shouldn't say if they've talked about it in the NBA. I know it's been talked about in other leagues. Is that a way that baseball may kind of square this circle a little bit, David, is instead of focusing on 50-50 revenue sharing, get the players to defer some money?
Well, I think 50-50 from the beginning was something the owners knew they weren't going to get. And because in order to do a 50-50 split, you've got to show the other side where the revenue is. There has to be an audit and agreement on all the revenue streams. You have to add up all the revenue in order to have it. Whether it's 60-40, 50-50, 30-70, none of that matters. That's just numbers. What matters is, as an owner, you don't want to give your books to the union. Under any scenario, do you want to show all sides of the revenue that the union would demand in that instance? So therefore, let's forget the split, because I don't think it's going to happen. Deferral, for me, I would vote against. I think that is a last. We take it if we had to, as an ownership group. But the thing with deferral is, and we've done this with player contracts, that is what I would do as a president to my owner. I'd say, listen, let's do Graham Lloyd in Montreal when we first got in the game. Hey, listen, we'll give him $9 million over 3 years, but the payroll this year, it's only going to be $1.5 million. And then we'll pay him in 4 years from now. God, who knows what it'll be in 4 years. We'll give him $5 million. Well, 4 years comes quick, and owners have started to learn that deferring money just doesn't work unless you've got a place to put that money where you can guarantee an interest, a rate of return on the use of that money. And that's hard during a recession. So I think deferral is not all that it's cracked up to be. Would that be a sort of a true loss for the owners if that's what they agreed to? I would say yes. I think it'll look different when the final agreement's done.
Well, let's talk about that then, because, the prorated salary agreement isn't going to hold because you don't have the revenue. The owners don't have the revenue from ticket sales. So that has got to be revisited. A revenue split isn't going to work because the owners, they may put that on the table, but they don't really want to open their books, and because they've never wanted to open their books to the players. And deferral is sounds like you think it's a non-starter from an owner point of view. So
that's too strong. Sorry to interrupt. I didn't say.
Okay.
Let me just say, I didn't say non-starter. I believe that would be sort of a last-ditch way to get an agreement.
Okay, so short of that, where does this, you know, like the players are going to get permission to shower, like in some of the stuff that they want, you know, I'm not making that up. That's actually one of the things they objected to in the health protocol.
Don't forget the hot tub.
And they want the hot tub. That's right. But where's this going to, you know, again, without some kind of shared risk, shared reward philosophy, which would require transparency, business transparency, where's this going to land?
I think you have to use it in terms of fans and when things return to some semblance of normal. I would propose a capacity deal where if you are allowed 25% capacity in your stadium for X number of games, then that means Y in terms of a reduction in your annual salary. If you're allowed 50% of capacity for X number of games, then you get Z plus A in terms of what you would receive in annual compensation. I think you would tie it to the ability to somehow get back fans into the stadium. And I think players are just going to have to swallow hard and realize that there's no compromising here from an owner's standpoint because the numbers are real. I've been there. And by the way, even for the Marlins, the numbers are real where we draw a social distance crowd to begin with, right? So we'll be at full capacity the minute we're allowed to be at 1% capacity. So there are teams that will be able to get back to what they were budgeting sooner than others. But for teams like the Yankees and Dodgers and Red Sox and Cardinals, short of 100% capacity, they've got real losses, and they're not going to pay any employees, whether it's players or front office or anybody, full rack rate because it just doesn't economically make sense.
All right, I got to ask you about the bus. I'm going to say my technical director, Derek Brandeo, flagged it to me. This is true. I do usually watch the pod or listen to the pod and watch the pod. And I normally try to keep up with you when you're on the local hour with Levitard because it's just so much fun. And actually, your moment at Dan Levitard's birthday party remains one of my favorite moments of all time, by the way. I know we can't say it on the air. Tell us about the bus, though, David. The bus and John Henry and Derek Jeter.
Well, to make a funny long story slightly shorter because I don't want to run out of time here, I will say that when you do a transaction, in any transaction, the key is understanding how badly the other side wants to complete the deal. And once you get an understanding that the other side is desperate to do something, basically the world's your oyster. You can ask for anything and you're going to get it. And so when John Henry was doing the transaction to buy the Red Sox in 2002 and sell the Marlins, he couldn't keep the Marlins. He was so far down the road of getting himself to Boston that I could have asked for a weekend in his house in South Florida, right? You could have asked for anything that sort of looked at as a pain in the neck for him, but not a huge financial issue, and could have used that leverage knowing that he couldn't walk away from the deal. The bus was, you know, a couple million-dollar tour bus, like a rock star bus that he had made for himself to get back and forth to games, to use with his mother, with his wife, with his daughter. And it's this incredible bus, and we wanted it. And so we said to John Henry, we need the bus. And he said, absolutely not. It's a non-starter. And we went through the entire negotiation. Every other week, it would be part of the list of issues, would be the bus. They would say, no, this is emotional for John Henry. He wants his bus. And I let it go because I knew my plan always was at the 11th hour, I was going to say, by the way, no bus, no deal. And it made Bud Selig so angry. It made John Henry so angry. But what did I care? I wanted the bus. And of course he was going to give in, and he gave in. So that's how we got the bus in 2002. Then in 2017, when the Marlins were being sold by Jeffrey to Derek Jeter, I was in the same position. Jeter had to get the Marlins. He wanted them so badly. So I could have asked for anything. I could have asked for signed Jeter memorabilia. I could have said, I need a dinner with Michael Jordan, who is a limited partner with the Marlins, like anything. But I said, I got a better one. You know, let's just not include the bus in this sale because it was an asset sale. And all of the assets from the Marlins were being transferred over to Jeter and his group. So So the bus was never part of the deal. So Conine, Jeff Conine and I, a former player and good friend who works for the Marlins as my assistant, we called Jeffrey one day and said, we want to buy the bus from you. And he agreed to let us buy the bus. So Jeff Conine and I are co-owners of that bus to this day, which is still operational, still being used. And the name of the company, and this was the funny part because it's so true, we named the company WGTFB LLC, which is We Got the Effin' Bus LLC. And every part of that story is true and funny, and it makes me smile.
And you drive around the bus, do you? Do you drive the bus around just for yucks?
So I don't do a lot of things for yucks, and okay, I definitely wouldn't drive that bus. No, so there are people who are professional bus drivers who drive it,
okay,
and we rent it out, so it goes to the Super Bowl. People rent it out on weekends. We take it to concerts, or we use it, and it's just it's fun. Why not have fun? Life is short. People are so serious and so sort of self-involved, and that's what Nothing Personal is, trying to just sort of take the canopy off the mystery that is sports and business and say we're all just normal people trying to smile once in a while.
Yeah, in a $2 million bus. David, thanks for doing this as always. Have a great weekend.
Bye, Jeff.